I'm Marie Cardi and I'm going to die. And so are you. And so is everybody you know. In these shorter episodes, La Petite Mort, The Little Death, I'll be speaking to people about the culture of death and dying. The art we make, the words we write, the absurd and beautiful ways we all process the act of letting go. As we know, there's no wrong way to navigate grief. We need to move towards it to move through it. Peter Goldsworthy is an esteemed novelist, poet, and a doctor. He's won a million awards over the years, including the Commonwealth Poetry Prize and the FAW Christina Stead Award for Fiction. His most recent fictional novel is Minotaur, which came out in 2019. But today I'm going to talk to him about his latest non-fiction work called The Cancer Finishing School. It covers his 2018 diagnosis with blood cancer. It is so interesting hearing the perspective of someone who has worked in medicine for so many years grapple with their own diagnosis and mortality, especially a writer who looks to books and words for comfort, which I do all the time. Peter's a pragmatist and an intellectual, and I think his perspective on death and dying is fascinating. Peter, I'm so thrilled to be speaking to you. Well, I mean, anytime I'm thrilled to be speaking to you. You are an award-winning novelist, a doctor, but what we're going to talk about today is cancer. In 2018, you went to see the doctor with a dodgy knee and your life took quite an interesting pivot, would you say?
Yes, as a bit, well, you might say a surprise, and it'd be an underestimate. But no, I needed reconstruction, a replacement of my dodgy sport ruined knee. And, I'd been managing for many, many years. I'd had an ACL reconstruction when I was younger to keep playing soccer. Finally, it had given way on me. So I had this. It went round the corner here, actually, to my friendly neighbourhood radiologist Sean Fowler, who I know, and had an MRI. And I, as usual, with all the pictures he's taken of my dodgy limbs over the years, you know, he called me into the office afterwards and said, "Yeah, you need a replacement." I'd actually written. I thought it was the medial meniscus, and in medical shorthand, that's MM. And I'd written on the I just referred myself, query MM. And Sean said, "Yeah, you need a replacement. There's no doubt about it. But I think it might be, look at the marrow. It looks like it might be multiple myeloma, which is a cancer of the blood cells. Probably the best way to think about it is like a leukemia, but it's a different white cell." And I thought, "Oh, come on, Sean, I'm just putting the idea in your head, the MM." But I didn't believe him. But all the same, I rushed off, took some blood from myself, sent it off, and sure enough, he was right. So that was a kind of weird, spooky, semi-spooky way. And I bought a lottery ticket on the strength of that coincidence.
Yeah, and you won $17.50, is that right?
Exactly right, the price of another ticket.
And you say often people in the book when they give you, I mean, you don't talk about the head tilt, which I had a very close friend with breast cancer, and the head tilt drove her crazy when people tilt their heads and say, "But how are you? How are you?" But you would tell people, your patients, your friends, that if you were going to get a cancer, that was the good cancer to get.
Yeah, I think that's, if you want people to give them, you want to give people, especially maybe your loved ones, the good news. And I remember then, when I was telling, and Lisa was the first person I told, but I'd waited a few days till I got the blood test back because I really, really didn't believe it. I mean, I guess you could say that's standard human denial, even doctor denial. I was just looking at the pictures again, and I'm looking at this MRI and thinking, I didn't believe him. What was going through my head? But that whole section of that book is about denial, I think, and the strange forms it takes. With me, one of the forms, that was really weird form it took, I suppose, not so much maybe denial, but denial of the seriousness, am I lucky to get this cancer? I mean, what material, for a doctor writer? This is going to be an interesting journey for me as a writer. And so I think that was one of the ways I coped with it. It wasn't such, a gift for my wife or my family at all. But so you did, then that's always fascinated me. In the book, there's a section on Joan Didion's book, The Year of Magical Thinking, which is one of the most perfect sort of descriptions of denial, I think, from the inside, you know, by another writer, of course, but she's talking about the death of her husband in that book, and quite beautiful, actually, I think, beautifully put, better than I can write about it, I think.
I think that beautiful balance. I mean, you're a novelist. You're a reader, which comes through so beautifully in the book as well. It's not a, for want of a better term, it's not a cancer memoir. It's sort of, it philosophizes. It's a book about reading. It's a book about writing. It's a book about being a doctor. It's anecdotes of patients. It's your own experience within and outside, inside and outside the medical system, which I think is incredible. And I just want to go back to a minute when you talked about telling your wife, Lisa, because between the diagnosis and when you told Lisa, there are a few days where you held this knowledge, which speaks to a little bit the denial of which you were just talking about. You were like, I don't want to worry her in case, you know, it's not bad. And then you found out. And I thought it was really indicative of a lot of thematic stuff in the book where you know how to break bad news to people as a doctor. You know, you've had that conversation with people before. You've told them about the prognosis or the cancer, but this was you telling your wife, and it was in your head. You were rehearsing different ways to tell her. That must have felt very surreal.
It was. I mean, I was, when the news came through, it was that the Friday afternoon, and I wanted to ring her straight away, but I thought, no, you know, you do that face to face and you don't do it on the phone. And so I had a bit of time to kind of prepare, you know, the speech and going through the different, what could be the alternatives. It was difficult thinking about that. But then on the other hand, I was thinking, well, it isn't such a bad cancer to get. I mean, the 5-year survival then was about 4 years. And I knew, we'd had friends who died of it, but I knew people who'd been going for a decade or more. So I knew that I was pretty good condition otherwise, apart from my buggered knees, and my kidneys were all right on the blood, and there are kind of big risk factors that make the prognosis worse with myeloma. Kidneys are one of them, and you know, your ticker and various other things. So I also had that thing going in my head, well, wow, you know, this is going to be some trip to write about from the inside. So you know, I guess certainly the first tears I shed over it were when Lisa cried. But then she said to me, well, what are you going to tell the children? And I said, oh. Then she reminded me that the Sunday was Father's Day. And I'm saying, oh, well, maybe we just won't tell them for spoil Father's Day. But, you know, Lisa immediately pointed out, you know, what we're going to pretend if nothing's going on. They'll see straight through us. And my second daughter is a doctor, or she's a psychiatrist. So we sort of nutted out a program for telling people. And I thought, well, my speech will, you know, improve with each retelling, the jokes will get better or whatever. And actually it turned out to be quite a profound experience. It started with you know, the sad news, and then turned into something, as I say in the book, something richer and stranger. And so we went on from there.
It even in that, when I first asked you about the diagnosis and the pivot, and you said, oh, it did come as a surprise, and in a way, it did come as a surprise, and it didn't, in the way that we all intellectualize our own mortality and our own death, and we all keep it at arm's length. You've seen people get diagnoses better, for want of a better term, than yours, or harsher than yours, and die. You've seen all of this in your vast medical career. So you were surprised, but then part of you went, statistically, given my age, cancer was going to get me eventually. So how surprised could you have been?
You know, I was thinking, I have a group of friends that I meet once a month, and two of them, you know, had cancer. And it's becoming a bit of a statistical norm at my age that, you know, people have been through it. I've got a good friend who said, oh, look, it's having, you know, every family has a cancer. It's like having you had an Austin 1800 once or whatever, a Datsun Bluebird. Every family has cancer in it somewhere. But also I found that with cancer, a lot of cancers, you go onto a drug called dexamethasone, which helps suppress the side effects of chemo. And it's a kind of a heavy artillery cortisone, and you don't sleep well, and you lie awake all night, so you ponder stuff. What started coming up into my mind were a lot of the cancer stories of my patients, which are in many ways certainly are more interesting than mine, or complicated, or more cautionary tales, or exemplary tales. And so, and also that I was worried about writing a whole book about my own cancer. I mean, even a doctor writing about, you know, his own cancer in my case maybe adds a level of ironic interest. or, you know, particular details being clearer or more easily explained. But, you know, the world's got a lot of cancer stories. And I thought one way of stopping this being just another sort of, okay, narcissistic cancer memoir or story of hypochondriasis or whatever, the patient stories add a certain objective level to it. I often could see myself refracted, my problems, you know, going through the various stages of this refracted in their stories, whether it's their courage or their stupidity or whatever, and it's all there. And the more I lay there, the more these came back from decades past, things you think you've forgotten, but they've left an important, if you know, subconscious residue. And certainly there are lessons, a lot of lessons to be learned. And then other writers, friends, and then, you know, even fictional characters I've sort of talked about a little bit in there, dragged in there. So I wanted it to have, you know, not just be a focus on me, I suppose. Maybe that's another displacement or denial.
I wonder if you, I mean, you talked about some of those, the cases from decades ago coming back, but you also, I mean, there's the inference in the book that this is the first time in a long time there's been an enforced pause in your life. Like even the notion that you've become accustomed to speaking to people in 15 to 20 minute increments because that's how long your meetings with people were as a GP, but to have that time and the not just enforced pause, but the sleeplessness on top of it because of the medication, that suddenly you had space for all these stories and these humans that you'd treated in the past to come back.
Yes, look, I think a big part of it has been that a part of that reconnecting, even, you know, even with the dead, long dead, has been my awareness that, and it struck me when I had the 6 months enforced sort of isolation after my stem cell transplant that slowly knocked me over with a feather. I missed them, you know, the live ones, I mean. And so that was a big lesson for me, that they were a kind of part of my extended family. I mean, it's Lisa's theory that, you know, I'm best at in conversation with friends, like 15-minute increments. I've grown used to kind of that's, and look, there is truth in that theory, I could tell you. But one of the lessons I hope I've learned it a bit with my patients anyway, is listening more and spending more time with them. I think one of the things writing has done, particularly writing novels, maybe more than poems, has made me more interested in people in terms of their stories over the years. I think I'd been, but it really struck me with some force how much I owed them, how much I'd learned from them, how much they'd told me over the years that I hadn't always taken notice of. But it came back now with a lot of it with some force. And the privilege of being in that position, you know, is priceless for any writer. I mean, we all get told stories and we all in whatever our day job is, if we have another day job, we're in contact with, you know, human stories. But there's a particular level in medicine, I think, that I've maybe belatedly realized I need to be very, very grateful for. I mean, I've always used my patients' stories and things they've told me over the years, but not so much, you know, in non-fiction, like a, you know, character traits in fiction and things.
It seems to be as well. I mean, I'm a writer as well, and what, you know, as Nora Ephron says, you know, everything is copied. So it's almost a part of the way of you processing, finding the catharsis, finding the understanding in your lived experience as a human, as a doctor, as a partner, as a father, is you often put it on the page. And you know, as you were saying, all these patients that have taught you things. I would assume that for years you thought they were teaching you medical things, and then when you were in this very human, vulnerable space, you realized how much they'd taught you about their own ways that they survived similar experiences or parallel experiences.
Yes, and I think that when I started out in medicine, you know, I got into medicine because I was good at maths, basically. That's how my generation got in there. We didn't. Well, I was a nerd, and
No, Peter, God, no, Peter, come on.
The time I enjoyed most as a medical student was in emergency, you know, where you kind of, it's a split-second diagnosis treatment. You don't get embroiled in ongoing, particularly intractable problems. And one of the things in general practice, so many problems are ongoing, and the relationship is continuing. The problems are intractable often or very difficult and take a lot of ongoing management and support. And that took me a long time to sort of get used to that. And that was a learning experience before this, I think. But for a long time too. Most of my working life, until maybe last 6, 7 years ago, when I did work full time for 3 years before I got sick, I've written in the morning and gone to see patients in the afternoon. And I think they haven't had the best half of me, you know, the patients. I think too often they were copy. You know, I don't want to be too hard on myself. You know, I enjoyed seeing them often, but I couldn't wait to rush home and, you know, get back to my manuscript. And I was maybe too quick often, I think. Look, I've talked in this about some mistakes I've made, but and I don't think there are, I hope there aren't too many more. I think the worst mistake I ever made was missing a diagnosis of myeloma, this is like 15, 20 years ago, in one of my patients. Because when I looked back on that at the time, I couldn't understand how I missed it. But there's kind of weird karma there. That was one of my early, I mean, I don't believe in karma, and I think it's purely accidental. But you could talk about a secular karma, you know, maybe I deserved it in a way, you know, not because there's actually a direct causal effect. But that was an amazing coincidence, I when I thought of it and when it popped up in my head one night.
And even looking at that specific example, I just want to touch on a few things about your patients and yourself on this particular journey. You even talk about in the book struggling with the terms they and we, because it's always been they, the patients, and you, the practitioner. And all of a sudden you've crossed over into this realm of the we, that you are now a patient in this space as well, and struggling to find that. I mean, you were still caring for people after your diagnosis.
Yes, up until the stem cell transplant. That's for the first few months of preparatory chemo. Naomi, who's a character in my book, my hematologist, wasn't keen on me, you know, continuing in, to see them. So I got help. I mean, I had, you know, a former patient of mine as a GP. She came to help, and my guardian angel Elaine, who had, you know, treated since she was a, you know, baby. And I could didn't have to see I didn't see anyone who was infectious, so I was reasonably careful with, because these are the things that worried Naomi while with my chemo. And so I did have help. The other thing I did do was displace, I think in retrospect, I displaced any anxiety I had about the cancer onto getting the practice off my hands and, you know, offloading my patients. And I was very lucky. And once again, it was on close of business. On the Friday before I went to hospital for my stem cell transplant, I sold the practice to the new owner who I've gone back to work for. And that was lucky. It would have been a nightmare, you know, having to write out thousands of case histories and just redistribute them elsewhere, or sack the staff or whatever. I mean, it wasn't a big practice, but it was just me in the end. But that was a preoccupation, maybe a useful worry, useful anxiety, and something I could do something about. And when I look back on it, that was a great displacement, I think. So I didn't have to worry about my cancer.
It's interesting hearing a man of mathematics and science, even though you said you don't believe in karma, and then you say secular, words like karma and luck. And I know you speak in the book of when your son Daniel was very ill, was the first and I think only time in your life that you've prayed. So these elements kind of appear intermittently through the book, but it always feels like a weighing up of everything. It's the doctor versus the husband. It's the father versus the, you know, your the GP or the friend. How can you be a friend to someone who is dying of a similar cancer and you're dealing with your own thing? Where does that balance sit with you? Where do you feel most comfortable in those spaces, I guess?
Look, I suppose I've always regarded myself as, you know, the supreme rationalist. That's not true, of course. None of us are. And certainly it's one of the kind of jokey discussions Lisa and I have a lot often about my supposed rationality. But I think I have been able to take a reasonably objective look at my cancer from that point of view and where it's going. But, you know, we're all prone to magical thinking. And I like to joke about that too, you know, my buying the odd lottery ticket or whatever, but that each way bet on the strength of it. That sort of is a little ritual, I guess. I do that. And like, if it's coincidences, and but it's still a ritual. I mean, I don't believe I'm ever going to win the lottery at a rational level, but I still do it. Well,
Gotta happen to someone.
yeah. Well, I do. We joke about it. We buy a Saturday night cross lotto, and we say, well, that we go into the news agent around here, and we say, well, she's our, you know, she's our financial planner, that lady. She's our retirement planner. That's kind of a rationalist joke too. But you still kind of you like the little sneaky hope, don't you, when you're looking at that?
What do you think was the most I guess, the darkest, almost vulnerable human moment for you when the rationalist couldn't be there anymore and it was just you?
When I was really crooked in hospital after the stem cell transplant, I think, though, even then, see, and that's in the book. Lisa would come in every day and she was probably existentially terrified, but she'd hide that. But I was in such a, I was in an almost inert state. I didn't taste food anymore. I couldn't read. I wasn't unhappy or depressed or even anxious. I was more my emotions as well, like my taste, like music. You didn't want to do anything, but the emotional bandwidth had shrunk completely. And so I don't think even then, when I was at my sickest and perhaps most precarious, it didn't really worry me, because whatever the electrophysiological mechanisms of those such feelings, they weren't there in the brain. And then things slowly came back. I do know the science behind this pretty well. And with myeloma in particular, and all the blood cell cancers and others, there are new drugs coming down the pipeline all the time now, immunological agents. And you fail one, you put on to the next one, according to the TGA recommendation. So the new drug I'm on, I had to fail four treatments to get it, but it's a terrific drug. And I've actually wanted to be on this one for quite a while, because you know what's coming. I do anyway, because I follow it a bit. But then again, there are the displacements. And I talk about that in the book. I'll wake up in the morning and I'll look at a poem I wrote in the middle of the night. And I think, I don't remember feeling that angry or that about it. Like, when you're talking about the anger or acceptance or the various stages, denial, I talk about a bit. But the poems put the lie to that a bit, I think. The prose doesn't. The journal doesn't.
Mm.
That's the rational part of the brain. But the poetry does seem to. And one of the things in the book is learning to trust the subconscious a bit. Not just what it spews out in the middle of the night in terms of a poem, an angry poem, say, but its fantastic ability to edit stuff and to reread stuff, as if while you're doing something else by torchlight under the blankets at night. I love that. You're talking about, it is a book about reading as well, what I read and what I wanted to read again. And that mysterious process where you pick up a book you haven't read for 30 years and you already find your opinion's changed. So your secret little editor's gone on, reading it under the mental bed sheets. Just as, and you'll know this too, all writers know this, that if you leave something alone, come back to it, the problems are solved often, or whatever you wanted pops into your head immediately. So something's gone on thinking about it deep down there in the trenches of the
unknown. In your case, one of the books you took, I think it was into hospital with you, you'd forgotten that the protagonist had cancer.
Yeah, I mean, and why did I choose that book? Why did I pluck it off the shelf? The Age of Iron is actually written by my friend John Kurtzea, and I'd read it a long time ago, and I like that book a lot. Things I remembered from it consciously, especially when I was going to hospital, that it had a mangy dog in it, and then chooks get killed. But I actually had forgotten that Mrs. Curran had cancer. I'd forgotten also that she'd started playing the piano again, and I'd forgotten that she'd turned to Marcus Aurelius, the Roman Stoic, and I'd been reading him immediately before I went into hospital. So obviously, at some level, I pulled these books. I just piled a whole lot of books into my bag to take into hospital with me, and that was one of them. I think I just looked at the title. I thought, that's a nice Stoic sounding book. The Age of Iron, the soul strengthening book. I took in a little book Lisa had given me by Oliver Sacks, Gratitude, which he four essays he wrote when he was dying. And so, I can understand why I picked the books, but that I'd forgotten important things about them that connected directly with me and my predicament. I guess my unconscious knew. That's probably what you're getting at, Marie.
Yeah.
What I'm getting at in the book too, at least after the actual event. Yeah.
I want to maybe talk about your subconscious or just emotional state. There was a I really love the book, by the way, and forgive me if I haven't said that already. But as a reader and a writer and a human, I loved that, all the different balances of places that it took us. But there's a passage, if you let me read, which you talk about the medication that you were on before, the Dex, which caused sleeplessness. And often in that time in the middle of the night, You reflect upon your own failings, the mistakes you've made, some of the medical mistakes you've made, some of the comical humblings, as you put them. And it's interesting because you've already mentioned the word narcissism once in this chat without me bringing it up, but that word comes up a couple of times. Other people pin that label on you or you pin it on yourself. There does seem to be some self-flagellation in that regard. But this passage I found kind of moving in a difficult way, where you say, I certainly lack empathy for myself, for my own predicament. Occasionally during my illness, I've felt an outbreak of the irrits at the uncertainty of outcome, but nothing that a black joke couldn't kiss better. Now I am neutral. On the matter of my survival, I have no firm opinion either way, if I can be bothered to think about it at all. Now, you did talk about when you're in hospital feeling that kind of numbness, but there doesn't seem to be, I mean, were you ever scared of dying?
Well, look, I think in all honesty, I can't say that I was. And that was when I was, you know, the whole emotional register, everything was numb then during that period. But even before, I remember wondering what my life expectancy was likely to be. I remember I asked Naomi, is it going to be 1 year or six, you know, because we need to do some forward planning. So I'm presenting that under a rational kind of framework, I suppose, but I can't really think I was ever scared. I was worried, you know, what I might leave, you know, to worrying about, you know, leaving Lisa and in the lurch if that happened, and you know, how my kids would react and stuff, and my parents, you know, dying before my parents. Although, as I say in the book, you know, mum's lost her memory a bit. I don't think I was. But then there are all kinds of, you know, the different defences, I think, that I can see now that I was using. And maybe against that wonder. And in the book, I mean, sometimes I get angry. And there are a couple of angry poems about what's happened. I think that's about the nearest I got to fear.
Are you scared now?
Well, no, I think look. Here we are. I'm 5 years, 5.5 years on, and so I've already gone past that 5-year survival rate, and I'm doing well. And I mean, I go in and go into the RAR every month and have my infusion. I'm back on the decks once a week. It was once a month, which was much easier on me and also on Lisa. my friend Sandy McFarlane, one of my friends, he's actually a psychiatrist too. He said, look, because it's very disturbing to sleep with someone on decks, I think. He said, look, it doesn't matter which one of you takes a sleeping pill, as long as one of you does. And that's a kind of solution there, I suppose. Because I did get to enjoy the decks nights a little bit at times.
Oh, yeah, that comes across in the book. Look, I'm not going to say you did the decks a disservice. I was like, I can see the benefits of this.
Because you don't actually care about your insomnia because you feel invulnerable about everything. Well, that's the other thing about decks. You get flat during the downside, and sometimes I suppose then I wondered a bit, well, it's a bit tough. This, not that I'm going to die, but that, oh, why do I have to go through this, you know, that sort of thing. But then I think, well, I've been so lucky, blessed in my life, and I know that. One of the other things this book is about luck and, you know, birthright luck, whatever, you know, living in this country luck, with the medical, with a reasonable medical system. I mean, leaving the third world out of it, I mean, I said in the book, 2/3 of all individual bankruptcies in the US are medical bankruptcies. You know, people have to sell their house to pay for their drugs we get for free here. So that's an incredible bit of luck. I think, you know, if you feel like counting your disasters or counting your fates, then counting your blessings is a pretty good way of restoring the balance there. I don't think it's taken any great strength of will for me to be like this. I just think that's the way I am. And I think the way my defence mechanisms have worked, perhaps. In the book, I talk about when Clive Jones wrote to me because, you know, he'd had leukemia for a while and said, you're on the glory road. You know, who better than you to write about it? Well, that confirmed my own view immediately.
You're on the glory road. You just mentioned briefly how potentially, I'll use the term, frustrating it was for your partner, Lisa, to attempt sleep next to someone who was had Dex-related insomnia. Lisa's a really present person in the book. I think that even though the journey is yours, the diagnosis, the medical treatments, Lisa's fear and grief and anxiety is palpable even there at the fringes, like throughout, you know, she's a great love of your life and was with you through all this, even though the book is not from her perspective, her pain is really there on the page. And I know that, you know, she's obviously read the book. And how has it been for her reliving that time even on the page?
I know it's been, look, it's been very, very difficult. And even, I mean, Lisa's read it, well, even as she's read it a lot, you know, probably several times now, but she read it aloud to me, just that, like that penultimate draft, which I always think is one of the most, where you can hear things that are wrong with it. And so I know it's been hard for her, and I know she'd have to answer that question, I suppose, but I think she's probably initially got over that initial existential terror. She still worries about it, but then she's pretty good at, you know, keeping that from me, I suppose, which is, I don't want her to necessarily, but so she's, I mean, she's got, or maybe she's got her own defense mechanisms that we haven't really examined too closely. I mean, I take the sleeping pills on Dexonite because I don't, what's the frolic in my insomnia, you know, thrashing around the bed and getting up and turning the light on. And I was off it for a while and then I was back on it, and then it was once a month. Now it's once a week, but it'll go back to once a month shortly, I think. So that, just that particular mechanical, the nighttime thing. But, you know, cancer is always, it's not my journey, it's our journey. And it's the same for, you know, in all families, I think. Sometimes there's a wider number of people involved. Sometimes there are people on their own. I can't imagine how difficult it is if you're doing this on your own, and a lot of people are. Having her there has been, for me, has been, you know, that's been the supreme luck, I think, you know, in getting it.
And as you said, it's now 5.5 years, which is great, and you're in remission. Yeah. In the book, you say you're always conscious that it could return at any time. There's always, with myeloma, that's always lingering there for you in the background. And the end of the book has a lot of beautiful reflection on how you see the world and what elements of seeing the world have changed for you, and appreciation of the world. Has that stayed with you? Are you still seeing the world through those eyes of a survivor?
Yeah, I think that's that part of the book is where I've lobbed, and I can reread it. And I'm pretty happy with that ending because I think it does sum up a lot of what I'm talking about. That it's about love, that last section, really, and it gets to it eventually. It's about luck as well. It's about the magnification, perhaps, of pleasures, you know, through the eyes of someone who's, you know, been on the point of losing all the wonders of life, all the pleasures of it. And how we connect with other people, and that's the portal of love, is that the most reliable one, I think. I was thinking about it the other day, I think, so I looked at it again. I've gone through and done a corrected version, you know, correcting everything I think could be fixed, you know, even, why can't I let it alone? And, but, you know, maybe if there's a reprint. And I'm thinking, no, that's not bad, that last bit. And I got there eventually. It took a long time, and we reread that a lot, at least to me, and that one a couple of times, and I kind of knew where I wanted to be, but I couldn't quite get it right until they kept extending, giving me a little bit extra deadline, because I knew it wasn't quite right. The Wallace Stevens poem coming in really provided, you know things will come to you. That's about trusting your subconscious to sort it out. You know stuff will come, but it doesn't do it on demand necessarily, and you have to wait around a bit for it to come. And so I needed that. And also the little bit about the painting my friend did, Mark Thompson, which I put in earlier, and then that had a nice little payoff, the Carpe Diem thing, you know, the going back to Herodotus and how the ancient Egyptians would wheel a corpse into the dinner party just to remind everyone to enjoy life.
I've tried that at parties. It does not go down well, I'm telling you. I've been uninvited from a lot of places, which is, that's on them, really. Peter, I just want to finish off with that ending of the book for people who will discover the book, who are yet to read it. What would you want people who haven't been through myeloma, cancer diagnosis, facing a terminal illness or an illness of that kind, what would you want them to know about love, of what you've learned?
Look, it's a really difficult problem, isn't it? Because not everyone has love. And but to certainly grab hold and appreciate what love you have got in your life. And don't take it for granted. And I think it's probably, I'm heading back towards, greeting card kind of sentiments here, but they're true. And one of the things I think I'd say in that last section is that cliches are all lying, they're lying there dormant, waiting to be true again, I think, or refreshed or revived. And there's nothing like, I guess, death or the sentence of death to, refocus your mind and reset it on maybe just a simple few truths that are what underpin our lives, really, even if when we've stopped taking notice of them or taking them for granted. So, but then again, I don't want to, boasting this, you don't want to boast about the love you've got. A lot of people don't have it. But I don't think I'm boasting. I hope I'm not
I
either.
don't think you're boasting. I think you're just celebrating it and acknowledging it, and you can absolutely do that. You deserve it.
Well, so do they.
The Cancer Finishing School, which is subtitled, which I love, Lessons in Laughter, Love and Resilience, is Peter's incredible book about his diagnosis and treatment, as well as, obviously, so much more. I've actually recommended it to a few people who are dealing with parents who have been diagnosed with cancer. So pick it up if you think it could be helpful for you or someone you love. Having conversations about grief can really stir up some unexpected feelings. So if anything's arisen for you today as a result of something you've heard, please look after yourself. I fully acknowledge it's a privilege to talk about mortality in this way, and there are so many specific resources available as part of the show notes, so look them up. Check in on how you're feeling internally, call a friend, take a walk, pat a dog, just trust yourself. It really would mean a lot if you'd consider supporting the show in whatever way you can. You do you, babe. You can subscribe to Marieke Hardy Is Going to Die on Patreon. And signing up means you'll have a monthly newsletter, writing updates, Q&A. There's a whole community on there of people that I just adore. So please join. This wild and weird podcast is made by me, Marieke Josephine Hardy, and a team of fully golden hearts. Sammy Peterson, Darren Scarce, Camilla McEwen, Eamon Leggett, and Lauren Egan. Our beautiful podcast theme music is by my dear friend, Lord Fascinator. And I'd like to give special thanks to James Milsom and Amelia Chapelot.